am here to remind you to fill up your tank before you go visit your vandalized graveyard adjacent abandoned homestead, and to remind you to switch to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica fair trade beans. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half calf, and a rotating seasonal blend for those who like variety. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this fantastic coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries. The Autopilot Coffee Club is not a coffee of the month club. It's completely personalized and flexible, and comes with all kinds of member benefits. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug is now offering 20% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? Start making the best coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. This is the Top 100 Project reminding you not to pick up hitchhikers and to plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
So howdy, partners, and welcome to the fourth annual Scary Movie Month here on the Top 100 Project / Next 100 Project. We started a day early this year, September 30th. And we're much obliged for tickling your ear canals with the Next 166 Project. We've been gazing back at movies from the past since March 2013, and since January 2016, it's been a random bunch of titles that caught our eye. Our reviews of the 123 entries on the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of bodacious American motion pictures are available for you to hear any old time. We hope you won't run away screaming when we warn you now that we spoil the movies we discuss. I'm the curious young fellow who gets clubbed to death after trespassing in a stranger's house, Ryan Ellis. And here's the lady who's been thoughtfully stored in a freezer by a confused serial killer, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
All right, so the theme has been established. We're talking about Texas Chainsaw Massacre and the coming attractions trivia for that. How many people die in this flick, and how many die by chainsaw? And according to the title of the movie on the opening card, it's Chain Space Saw. Even though the rest of us would just use one word, chainsaw.
Anyway. Because it is one word, chainsaw. I don't know why they separated it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So five people die?
That's correct.
The four kids and the hitchhiker gets killed. He gets run over by the truck at the end of the movie.
Pretty brutal death, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Maybe the most brutal of all the deaths. Well, maybe that chainsaw death.
I think that Franklin is the most brutal death. Franklin gets chainsawed and so does Kirk. I think it's just two of them that actually die by chainsaw, right?
Kirk and Jerry get clubbed over the head.
No. Isn't Kirk alive when he's slaughtered in front of...
I think it's supposed to be that he's dead on that table.
Oh, he makes her watch.
Mm-hmm. And we never do see her die. Apparently, Pam, so that's Terry McMinn, has said that, I'm resourceful, my character was resourceful, and she got out of there. Possible. Pretty unlikely. I'm sure she died. In fact, it may be her body that's sitting in front of Sally at the end at that very bizarre, probably the most bizarre dinner of all time in movie history. But there's food in front of them, and it looks like it might be nice and fresh. It's at least Kirk. It might very well be Jerry and or Pam that are on their plates. Horrible thought. And this movie is more suggestive than actually all that violent. Much like a movie we're going to cover later this month with the word Saw in its title. That's just going to be called Saw. There's gore in that. Way more gory in the sequels. Same with this. This movie is more suggestive than it actually is gory, including when Franklin is chainsawed to death. If you see any blood, it's minimal, and you do not see that chainsaw go into him at all.
You see the chainsaw go into Leatherface's leg.
The only person who actually gets cut with a chainsaw on screen is himself at the end. You're right. Well, this movie was almost called Head Cheese, and that is what the hitchhiker describes. My brother makes a great head cheese. So, Head Cheese. And if they'd called it that, very confusing. This is actually a great title. One of the things about this movie that's so awesome is it isn't really accurate, as we just established, but it's a cool title. Head Cheese? What does that even mean?
The title kind of goes with the marketing tool that they said it was based on a true story.
Mm.
Oh, it's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You've all heard of it.
Right.
Head Cheese is brains.
Right. Yeah. And it was released 45 years ago on October 4th, 1974. It cost only a few hundred thousand to make, but raked in about $30 million at the box office way back then. Big hit. No one really talks about this as a hit the way they did with... Well, Halloween was bigger, but Halloween 4 years later, that was thought of as the biggest independent hit. And maybe it is. I guess it's bigger than this.
At the time it was. It beat the record that Texas Chainsaw Massacre set.
And maybe that's why people don't talk about this as an independent horror hit that cost zero to make with no stars. Halloween had established actors in that cast, actually, more than this did. We're going to talk about all the actors, and almost none of them were or became well-known, apart from being this one movie. Okay, Bev, you better establish what the movie's about with the skinny.
It's summer in Central Texas, and a series of bizarre grave robberies have brought a group of young friends to investigate their grandfather's grave and along the way visit their family's abandoned homestead. A search for gas leads them to a mysterious house where a family of cannibals kill them one by one, save for one survivor, Sally, who gets an extended eerie glimpse into this twisted family before she finally takes her opportunity to escape.
Funny, too, that Halloween is thought of as the movie with the girl survivor, the lone girl being Jamie Lee Curtis of all of her friends that survives. And this also did that first. Yeah. I'm sure there are other movies that did
before this one. It did a lot of things before Halloween. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But Halloween does get a lot of credit that this movie probably deserves.
Or, in a nutshell, clinically insane teen ditches her annoying brother in rural Texas.
Ditches him once he's been chainsawed to death.
The nutshell is supposed to miss the point. This one really misses the point. And I say clinically insane because in the very last shot of her in the movie, she's weeping, basically, shrieking, and of course, laughing, because I think this girl's mind just broke.
I think that her performance is the key to this movie working, really.
We keep on mentioning Halloween. That's also true. Jamie Lee Curtis is the best actor of the young people. You didn't like that movie, and partly because of the, what you think, at least, and I guess I have to agree with you to some extent, the shitty performances by her co-stars.
Yeah, they're annoying and terrible.
Not Jamie Lee Curtis, though. No,
she's great. And the actor who plays Michael Myers is great. But the rest of the teenagers and the actor playing the psychologist who's following them
Donald
around
Pleasance.
Like a ghoul. Yeah, also
awful. A little over the top, yeah. This cast gets off pretty fast in the movie. They don't even last, I don't know, 45 minutes into this. Well, it's only an hour and 23 minutes long. This film is so short. I'd forgotten how short it is. Okay, before we get into the proper conversation, just a few numbers on Texas Chainsaw. 88% of critics like this film on Rotten Tomatoes. 52 fresh, 7 rotten, for an average of 7.9 out of 10. And 82% of audiences. I bet those numbers surprise you. They surprise me. I thought this movie would be liked by the critics because it is pretty well respected, despite its subject matter. But those are strong reviews.
They are.
Your thoughts in a second. None of the sequels or the remake get anything close to a fresh tomato. I looked at that just earlier today. One of them is in the 40s, maybe. But the rest of them are in the teens, and the 20s, and the 30s for their Rotten Tomatoes numbers. And the movie was also nominated for the Top 100 Thrills, and Leatherface was a nominee for the Top 50 Villains, and he would have been a pretty good choice. Next week's movie, the villain did make that list. All right then, so this was your first ever time seeing this version of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You've seen the remake with Jessica Biel. What'd you think of the original?
It's fine. It probably gets most of its credit for the last act, which is really innovative and chilling. Marilyn Burns, as I said, she sets the bar for the final girl performance. And if she hadn't pulled it off so well, we would not be talking about this film today. But the first hour-ish is uneven and boring. It's a mixed bag of actors. Some are good, some are terrible. Franklin.
Yeah.
But I will give it credit for its innovations. I really don't see how people consistently put this at the top of the list of the best horror films ever made. It kind of makes me think of Blair Witch Project, which is a movie that deserves credit for breaking out with a nothing budget, with nobody, actors and directors, and truly inventing a genre. The found footage genre was invented with that movie, and it made so much money off of its budget. Truly an incredible story, and anybody watching that movie 20 years later will be like, it's fine. I think that's like this. It's fine.
I think if you're a camper, Blair Witch has more of an effect on you. I'm not a camper. I haven't been in a tent in a very long time. The extent of my camping since I was in my teens is in cottages. I remember thinking that because when I saw Blair Witch, and we were going to cover that movie this month, by the way, or next month, I guess, technically, but we decided to do movies with fours. That'll be the theme. 74, 84, 94, 2004. And I already gave away the 2004 film being Saw, the original Saw. But I would have, I think, been more affected by Blair Witch when I first saw it. If it had not been on an afternoon, sunny day, in the middle of the summer when I came out, it was about 2:30. I saw a noon show, so it wasn't even 2:30, I guess. It was probably more like 1:30. And if I was a camper and it was nighttime when I came out of the movie, it might have been more in my head. This one, back to Texas Chainsaw, doesn't really scare me anymore either, but I've seen it lots of times, including on Halloween night. Because Halloween, the original, was my go-to movie on Halloween for at least 3 years in a row. And I always watch one or two or even three scary movies on the day itself after you've gone to bed and the candy's been given out and the kids have been rightly scared in our neighborhood. But Halloween's no longer my go-to because I've seen it enough times and it definitely doesn't affect me anymore, even though I think it's a better film than you do. Certainly better made than I think you're giving it credit for, especially cinematography and the music and everything. This movie is almost deliberately, maybe they didn't think at the time they were doing this on purpose, but looks dirty, looks a little disgusting, even though, again, we don't really see that much blood and gore, because it does feel more like a documentary style is a little bit much, I guess, but it does feel more real than a lot of horror films do. Blair Witch obviously is the same thing. And I find it pretty effective, partly because, like you say, that last act, but even when Franklin gets killed, I knew it was coming, I was taking a note at that moment, and when you hear the out of nowhere, it actually made me jump a little bit, and I've seen this movie probably five or even six times by now, so I'm surprised that it still got me, even though I knew Leatherface was coming out of the dark to cut into Jerry's guts. And incidentally, both families, the Hardesties, and I guess they're called the Sawyers, the sequels and the remake, I mean, established that the Chainsaw family, the Sawyers, have somebody in a wheelchair. There are some connections.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
There's no females in this version of Texas Chainsaw, no women or girls, although the remake does have women and girls and some camper that are at least part of this family in some twisted way. And the prequel and some of the other films have established that women are part of this as well. All right, so the film was set on August 18th, 1973. An opening title card establishes that very clearly. And then there's the opening narration that's both read and written on the screen exactly as it's read. I always find that very strange when they do that because you don't really need both. Just have the guy read it. And it is John Larroquette from Night Court.
His first film credit, I think?
Mm-hmm. He was paid with a joint, apparently. A little marijuana was his pay. He did the narration for the 2003 remake as well, and apparently he was happy to do it. I read somewhere that he's never even seen this movie or hadn't seen it for a very long time, but he probably took the gig because why not? If you're going to give me a joint, hey, cool. It'll take me a few minutes to do this in some little sound studio. And much like in Dirty Dancing, you never hear his voice again. In this case, you don't need to. It is weird in Dirty Dancing that you hear Baby's voice in the very beginning, but she never narrates again. In this film, it's like this guy sets a scene and pretends, like in Blair Witch, that this is all real, this really happened, but of course it did not.
It's different with an omnipotent narrator. I think you can get away with opening up with the narration and never returning to it, rather than the narration in Dirty Dancing that's first person from the main character.
I've said before in other horror podcasts we've done that I think a lot of the movies in the 70s had a Vietnam influence. You send your kids to an unknown place, Vietnam, and bad things happen to them. Really bad things happen to them because of technological warfare and whatnot. Also, when this movie was set, not when it came out in 74, but when it's set in August 73, the movies that were playing in theaters at the time were Jesus Christ Superstar and Westworld, the Yul Brynner film where he's stalking, which of course is what happens in this film, obviously with Leatherface and Sally for a good portion of the middle section. He's stalking his prey. And Jesus Christ Superstar is about someone who was butchered and died horribly, which is what we see in this film with multiple people. Again, we don't really see it happen, but we know it happens. So whether or not that was intentional, I think that's one of the subtexts of this film, is that you've got Vietnam still going on, and these other films that would have been playing, these kids could have seen them at this point, and then this real thing. You think this is bad. One of these things supposedly really happened, meaning the Jesus thing. And Westworld's just a fantasy film. But you might have seen these movies, but guess what's in store for you if you go poking around down in Texas?
Toby Hooper, the director, said he was also trying to recreate the lack of sentimentality and the brutality that they would show on TV news, who wouldn't hesitate to show gore or scare people in the name of, quote, informing the public, but really getting ratings. But I think he's acknowledged, and a lot of critics say that the movie's a reaction to 1974, which was a time when America really came to distrust authority in the wake of Vietnam and Watergate and the 1973 oil crisis. Hooper also said that the title card at the beginning asserting that this is a true story is a marketing tool that's supposed to take advantage of this mistrust of the news. So it's like, well, if you're going to lie to us, then I'm going to lie to the audience. Why should I be beholden to a standard that the government itself isn't beholden to?
Just like Fargo and Blair Witch had title cards in their films that implied, said, this is based on a true story, and in neither case is that true.
Blair Witch really took advantage of that as a marketing tool, and it worked. People went to that movie believing that was a true story. And I bet that there were people in the 70s who left being like, can you believe that happened? Can you believe there's a family that this happened to? It's significant also from the point of view of social commentary that the film is set in a crumbling farm home, once the very symbol of American life, a homestead. The young people, they come in there, they see it as a novelty, it's a throwback, and now it's just this dried up town with a gas station that doesn't have any gas and families of grave robbing cannibals. And of course, the Sawyer family had a long history of working at this slaughterhouse until they were put out by technological advances. And I guess they were just so married to slaughtering animals that they then had to turn it on humans.
They got desperate. Not to forgive them, because I may have been a little forgiving of Fletcher last week with Whiplash.
They're worse.
But if you're going to cover movies like this and get into the weeds with it, then I think you have to look at from their point of view, especially when it is one of the more iconic villains of all time, Leatherface, even though the sequels, and to some degree the prequel, which I don't like as much as this, are pretty terrible. For all of the iconic killers, the slashers of the 70s and 80s, Leatherface's future movies are probably the worst of all of them. And that's saying something, because some of those sequels and prequels to Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, and Halloween were pretty terrible, too.
It's curious that Leatherface is the standout villain from this movie, because...
He's not really a villain.
He's a villain.
Well, because he kills people, but he is completely obedient to his family. And you see that again in the prequels. It's important to keep talking about that, because if you see the chronology of where it's supposed to be, and of course they retcon that decades later, what's that, 30 or so years after this movie was made, when they didn't intend that in this film. You're not supposed to know all these things. But Leatherface worked in the slaughterhouse, as I guess they say in this film, don't they?
Intellectually disabled.
But yeah, he's a messed up person. He's not quite there. He's put in the situation and he's told what to do by his family, and his family is starving and need to make money somehow. Again, not forgiving them. But that may have been the idea of what's called the cook in this film, or old man in the credits here, Jim Seidow, or Seidow.
Is he the one, the gas station attendant?
There's that really good scene where he misleads that he's going to help out Sally till he wants to tie her up. Mm-hmm. We don't know at that point he's in on it all the time. But either he or Edwin Neal, who plays is just Hitchhiker in the credits, were the ones that had the idea. Now, it is strange that the Hitchhiker has been grave robbing. We find that later on when the old man is berating him for doing it. And my question for that, I guess reasonably good, is... If they need meat to survive and to sell it to other people, then why is the hitchhiker robbing graves? Because that's not really meat anymore.
I thought that was just because they were creeps.
Well, he is, because he's not supposed to be doing it because the old man's telling him not to. Leatherface may have helped him out, but I don't get that feeling. Leatherface feels like the woman, even though he's a male.
He literally wears like an apron.
Right.
Or is it his full dress?
The woman who's back home taking care of the house.
Yeah.
Cooking and cleaning.
Doing what he's told.
What was Leatherface doing before Kirk came into the house? And then Pam? And then Jerry. And it's one of those things where the actor contributed a lot of great things. A lot of these ideas were Gunnar Hansen's. Jerry comes in. Now he's had to kill three teenagers in about maybe an hour. One day, though, anyway. And he sits down and... Whoa, 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 whoa. And there's that scene where he's poking his tongue out through the mask and you see the fake teeth and everything. And the idea there is, where are they all coming from? What's going on? What is happening?
Yeah.
And when Jerry comes in, the third kid that he's had to kill... Well, he decides to kill. But in his mind, he's had to kill. And they are trespassing, so... Texas people might say, I can see why they would. Maybe they should have just shot those fucking kids. But anyway, after that point is when he becomes an aggressor. And this is set up very nicely. When you hear earlier on multiple times that generator that's running, you slowly hear it as they get closer to the house, whether it be Jerry or whether it be earlier Kirk and Pam. But when Sally and Jerry are getting closer to the house, you hear the generator and they think, oh, there's going to be civilization there. Something's going on. And then suddenly, bum, 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 out of nowhere.
You mean Sally and Franklin. You said Sally and Jerry.
Oh, right, because Jerry's already dead. And Leatherface has become the aggressor now, though, and he's going after them. He's deliberately killing Franklin, when before, you can make an argument that what he did to those kids, be a shitty argument, but you can make it, was home defense. But now he's going on the offensive, and he tries to kill Sally, including when he goes around some corners. And because he's wearing lifts, he has those comical turns, almost like that old school silent film mentality. Or in Rules of the Game, is it Marceau? The Gamesman? Is that what his name was?
Yeah, it was Marceau.
Where he has some of the same... Charlie Chaplin-esque turns in the house, probably played for comedy in that film. Well, Gunnar Hansen has the same thing going on here because he couldn't turn very fast. Also carrying a real chainsaw.
Oh yeah, I can't believe that.
And running after an actress who was slower than him. Dude. So you see at some points so he's almost right behind her. He is right behind her, but he almost catches her. He has to stop deliberately and just cut up things in the background, including the twigs around him, because he was going to catch her easily.
It's nice because at that point... His motive is no longer to protect the homestead or to make her meet. His motive is, if she gets away, they're going to tell on them. So they have to capture her. They're very determined to capture her at that point, simply to keep their family secret a secret.
For somebody who's mentally disabled, can you imagine being out there in the dark like that, though? Looking around, your chainsaw's not running, obviously. And then you would hear these two people.
They're yelling, yeah.
Yeah, you don't know that more people are out there beyond them. You probably don't know that those two are out there, because how could you? You don't know there's five people in that van. You've already killed three. But what if there's even more beyond that? There's all kinds of deeper layers to this if you look at it from Leatherface's point of view. Thomas is his real name. Again, we learned that in the future movies, or I guess you could say a previous movie by being the prequel.
You feel a lot of sympathy for Leatherface, right?
Maybe because unlike Freddy Krueger, especially Jason Voorhees, have been wronged in some way, and they turn it into something really terrible for decades, killing people who have nothing to do with why they're mad. But Leatherface has been told to do this by his family. The hitchhiker seems to be his brother. Mm-hmm. The cook, I guess, is their father. And then, of course, they call him Grandpa, John Duggan, who was just a kid who plays this, looks like he's a 140-year-old man. He didn't want to get in that makeup again when he did the first day, so they did one hell of a long shoot. And one thing about this film, one of the big themes, is how hard it was to make it and how uncomfortable it was to make it.
Oh, yeah.
Edwin Neal, who is the hitchhiker, served in Vietnam and said that was better than doing this movie. Partly because the scene at the end, at the dinner table, that food started to rot and the house was so hot because John Duggan wanted to shoot as much as possible. That meant a more than 24-hour day.
And they were shooting on a small grain film that needed a lot of light. All those lights heat up a house in no time.
And it was a heat wave. There's a story as well. A producer talks about this on the making of, I think it is, where Gunnar Hansen, wearing the makeup and that terrible shirt that apparently started to smell so bad, people couldn't even be around him, especially at lunch after a while.
God.
But all these guys are in this little facility. I mean, I think maybe it was more of Leatherface was outside towards the end sequence. He looked weird to the producer, and he thought, even though he couldn't see his face, I guess he had the mask on. So he threw him in his car and realized, this guy's going to pass out from heat exhaustion, maybe even worse. So he threw the air conditioning up. This was not a fun shoot by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, Gunnar Hansen even cut Marilyn Burns' finger in the scene where he's supposed to cut her finger. And of course, when you do visual effects with that kind of thing, either it'd be digital now, or in those days, it'd be a blood tube behind the finger, but it wouldn't work. So he actually just cut her finger.
Hooper said that everybody who worked on that film, especially the actors, got injured in one way or another throughout the production. They clearly didn't give a damn about safety. There was more than one incident where Gunnar has a real chainsaw and he has to get really close to somebody so that they can get the shot. This is insane. No film set should ever put their actors' lives at risk the way that they do. And he said that by the end of the production, they all hated his guts. And to make things worse, they were promised a percentage of the film in lieu of getting paid. The film made an enormous profit. They should have won the lottery in a way, but Hooper got them all screwed when he got his distribution deal, and they walked away with a pittance, something like $8,000 to split between 20 of them.
It's funny because when you look at the cast list, nobody seemed to work with Hooper again, because Toby Hooper directed Poltergeist. There's always a story about whether or not Spielberg actually directed that, but Hooper has the directing credit, so let's say he directed that. And Hooper directed other things, the first sequel, Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2. But you don't see Marilyn Burns or Alan Danziger, who plays Jerry, Paul Partain, who's Franklin, except for William Vail, who played Kirk, who was in Poltergeist. Most of these people never worked with him again, and that probably is deliberate. I'm guessing Edwin Neal especially didn't want to after what he said about him.
Who would work with someone like that again, who put them through that, who put their lives at risk?
I guess so. Neal didn't act in anything for 11 years. And he's still acting now. He was in JFK, one of the many actors in that. This was his debut. It was Gunnar Hansen's debut. Most of these actors don't have a lot of credits in their entire resume. Alan Danziger only made one other movie in total, and that was before this. This was the last film he ever made. I don't know why. Maybe he just said, movie making is not worth it. To hell with it. I'm going to do something else.
What about Marilyn Burns? I don't think it's hyperbole. She's wonderful in this movie.
She's very believable, especially. The word might be better to say she's believable.
Yeah, okay, that's fair.
Shrieking constantly. It's almost like you hear the stories about Shelley Duvall in The Shining. Nicholson has said since, Shelley had to cry for about a year straight.
Yeah, she had to be hysterical.
And do take after take after take. And this wasn't that long a shoot, really, but Marilyn Burns had to do the same kind of thing, but even more over the top because of what's going on with her. I think she's got an even tougher role to play than Shelley Duvall had, but in a shorter period of time. She was in the 1994 sequel, The Return of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Matthew McConaughey's in that. Over the top, but fun. And not so good, because she has to play the duller role, is Renee Zellweger. And their agents did not want that film to get out there, even though it was made before either of them had become stars. And then when they were stars, let's release this all over again. I guess their agents squashed that. And I just saw it on YouTube a week or two ago, because I knew we were going to do this soon. It really just remakes the first film, basically all over again. McConaughey's character is quite different. I guess in a way, he's either the hitchhiker or the cook. Maybe the two of them combined, he's the hitchhiker and the cook. And incidentally, Gunnar Hansen never played Leatherface again, except he's in Chainsaw 3D. Or is it Texas Chainsaw 3D? Anyway, he was in that, but not as Leatherface again. So he never played this character again. Other people always played him in other movies. He died a couple of years ago, actually. Gunnar Hansen did. Didn't really act all that much. Most of these actors didn't. Marilyn Burns, though, getting back to her, has to be hysterical, has to shriek, has to run around and avoid a guy with a real chainsaw in some of those scenes, like you said. When Leatherface is chasing her through the woods, they do this at least twice, I think. It must be one of those long lenses that makes something from behind seem like it's right on top of somebody else. You'd see it in Stand By Me when the train is coming after the kids. When they shot that scene, they had a long lens, so it made it look like the train was right behind the two kids, when it was really probably at least 500 feet behind them. You see a similar shot in this, when Leatherface, who's certainly bigger, and with the lifts, he's even bigger than he would have been. Marilyn Burns is in front of him, and she's in the foreground, but he looks like he's inches behind her, even though he's probably quite a ways behind her. It's a great shot. It's one of the better shots in the whole film. I think they do at least twice in that chase scene. But getting back to the hitchhiker and all his motivations about grave robbing and whatnot, and they need meat for food, that opening shot after the credits is that cool image, and I've seen it so many times now, and I still don't entirely know what it is. I guess it's multiple people that are sitting on top of that fence post, but it's such a weird, creepy thing. It's a great setup for the film.
Great music, too.
Not really music, though.
No,
it's more just sound effects, and apparently it's supposed to be what animals would hear in a slaughterhouse.
Oh, my God.
So it's more of a quote-unquote music score by Wayne Bell, and then Hooper himself had a credit as music composer.
It's like they sent a musician to a junkyard or something and told them to make a song.
I think they used the exact same sound effect of that, almost like a Polaroid snapshot.
Yeah, the light powering up.
And you see that in the opening of this film, and I think you see it in the opening of the remake in 2003. So not really a music score, per se. You can't criticize music because there isn't really any in this film. Wayne Bell, went on to work with Richard Linklater, another Texas guy, incidentally, on some of his films, but in a sound capacity, not as a composer. So music score, not really. But anyways, the hitchhiker is robbing these graves just because he wants to, I guess. And that is the plan of Ed Gein. So it's this film, Psycho, Silence of the Lambs, all play off the Ed Gein thing. A real guy who was a grave robber and also
a murderer.
Yes, but more than anything, he was robbing graves, and he was sleeping with dead bodies, and you see a little bit of that in Devil's Rejects, even. So a lot of movies that play off this Ed Gein guy.
He's the most influential murderer.
One of. And one thing I noticed this viewing is that we do see that weird talisman, or maybe more than one, but definitely a weird talisman-type thing, in the Hardesty family home. Seems to be the hitchhiker put it there, because he's got some of the same kinds of things when he's in the back of their van. Ed O'Neill is over the top in that scene, but he does set a really creepy tone. So is it like he's cursing them right off the bat? He seems to have drawn them in. It's almost like it's either fate or it's deliberate, because he's robbing graves and these kids are going to check on their grandfather's grave. And I guess everything is fine in the end. But they're there for that reason.
It is curious how they pick him up in the first place and how long they put up with him when his behavior is clearly scary. And I guess they have this strength in numbers thing where they're like, there's five of us, there's one of him. What's the worst that could happen? I guess it's not his fault that they come back to the house later. It's kind of a coincidence, actually.
That's why I say maybe it's fate.
Yeah.
Of course, it'll always be the Hitchcock answer, especially in a horror film. They have to go there. There's no movie. But also, it does seem like they're drawn in a way, and also set up in a way. And it's dumb luck on the part of the hitchhiker that it works out, I guess. Although he's the one who dies, it doesn't work out too well for him, does it?
No.
When the hitchhiker's in the van, or I guess it's soon after, Franklin says it's like he's from a whole family of Draculas. And the later grandpa drinks Sally's blood like he's a vampire.
Do they have powers? Some kind of voodoo going on in there?
Well, think about it. If you're going to eat meat, and this movie certainly, my nutshell at one point was going to be, I think I'm going to have to swear off meat and hitchhikers.
There was a few people said that they turned veggie after watching this film.
I can see why. But if you're going to eat meat, and this whole notion behind, say, blood is in your steak, or blood would be on your chicken, if that was the way it was served to us in the grocery store, and we'd all be repulsed. But if you think about it, what the hell is the difference? If you're going to have a problem with that, where do you think that meat came from? How do you think it got there? It's not what we see in this movie specifically, but people like this worked in a place that gave you that meat. It's not a nice process. If you're going to be an animal lover and you eat meat, you're a hypocrite. I'm admitting I am. We've talked about this in other podcasts before. For the longest time, I was not somebody who ever said I was an animal lover because I felt hypocritical. And this movie, in some ways, is pointing that out. And these people are desperate. When the kids go to the gas station but don't get gas, but they do get barbecue. Hey, I got us some barbecue. Who's in that bag?
Oh, I never thought of that.
And we see a lot of cars later on when Kirk and Pam first get to the house that aren't really truly hidden, but they'd be hard to find. You'd never see them driving by that house or on the highway or anything because it is hidden well enough. It looks like what happened to Sally and the rest of them happened to other people before.
They've obviously slaughtered people before. There's a whole thing in the house. Now, you're being very forgiving where you're like, they need to do this. They have to. They have no choice.
They think they don't.
Okay, they're pretty into it. They don't seem that reluctant.
Well,
and
even
in that final scene around the dinner table, you aren't seeing a family who's reluctantly killing people and eating them. You're seeing a family who is thrilled.
Faster, son. He's got a taste for meat now.
Yeah.
Simpsons again. Well, even the cook is inconsistent because he says about how, I understand killing, but I can't do it myself. I can't get behind the idea of it. And yet at the same point, he joins in the leering and the torture of this young girl. And like I said before, if you're going to actually kill her, if that was always the point, then why are you putting food in front of her?
Yeah, I don't know why they want her to eat. They keep making a big deal about it.
Why are you wasting her? They're desperate for food.
But I think it's probably just to remind everybody that they're cannibals.
I'm also just looking at this from the point of view of the criminals and the villains, because I think that's what makes this kind of film interesting. We're going to do that with the rest of this month, because we are covering a few serial killers. Also, like I said, they're trespassing. It's for a good cause. Kirk doesn't go in the house saying, I'm going to steal your shit. He's just trying to find somebody to talk to get gas, because he thinks they have gas because they have the generator. And then out comes Leatherface, slugs him with that big club. He dies. It's a steep price to pay for trespassing. But that does lead to the best shot in the whole film, and not just because Terry McMahon has a nice bottom. That famous shot, as she goes up the swing set, starts walking towards the house, this low track, the camera just slowly follows her. For a cheap production, there are some great shots in this.
Yeah, which is a curiosity, because there are some scenes that are shot that look so great and the camera's in exactly the right place, and they're actually quite innovative in the way that they bring up the tension or make you feel like you're crazy. And this is a beautiful shot, which doesn't explain why there are so many shots, especially in the first half of the film. Forget rudimentary. They're bad. Poorly blocked. It reminds me of when I was in film school and we had an afternoon and two dimes to rub together to make a movie. And it usually just came down to, this is where the camera can go right now. If we don't just get this shot the way that we can, then we're not going to get it at all. And I wonder if it's because of the poor budget, especially the scene in the van with the hitchhiker. That scene with Sally and Franklin arguing in front of the van at night, you can barely see their faces. There's no close-ups. It goes on way too long. And it just feels like, well, this is the shot we could get on the day, and that was that. We had no light, and we couldn't move the camera, and so this is what we got. And it's so uninspired. But then you get these shots that are the opposite. You can tell where either they still had money or still had steam or still had inspiration to do something. And then the scenes where maybe they just let it go.
Those tight close-ups on Sally's eye.
So cool. Love that.
Incredibly tight. It's basically just her eyeball. You can see all the blood vessels
veins,
in there.
Yeah. I don't even know how they did that. They would have had to have like a macro lens, or maybe they blew it up, although I don't think they do, because it's still like a pretty clear shot, and they shot on 16.
So it's not a great looking movie, so if they blew it up, we would have really seen
that. Yes, yeah.
Incidentally, we watched the DVD. It's 1.85:1, but it didn't fill our screen. I was going to blow it up to fill the screen like we've done with other movies before, but I thought it's going to look that much worse if I do, which I guess in some ways the grain would have made it really fit the grindhouse theme of this film. That wouldn't be the worst thing in the world, but I didn't want to do that, so we left it be the postage stamp on our TV. But anyway, when you see Pam go into the house, and then Leatherface comes out, so now he's killed Kirk, and he sees her. And he must really be confused, what the hell's going on? Although I guess this has happened before. But then maybe before, it was the cook or the hitchhiker bringing people home, and they just serve these people to him, whether it be alive or dead, into the kitchen, and he just does his work. So maybe this is completely foreign to him. Although he does react pretty well with that club. He's ready to do what he has to do to them. Anyway, the shot where Leatherface comes out and snatches Pam off the porch, and then walks back in and hangs her on the meat hook, is my favorite moment of the whole film, for a lot of reasons. One of the connections to another film, and it just came out a few months ago, is in Midsommar. Both movies have a lot of horrible deaths in broad daylight. Some bad things happen in Texas Chainsaw at night, but almost everything that happens is in the piercing sunshine, including that scene when this weird-looking dude who's tall has this mask. We haven't really seen him all that close yet. Even that's not really a close-up, per se. What is he wearing on his face? That's not his face, obviously. We don't know then what it was. Especially, first time you see this movie, it would be even freakier. And yes, Leatherface has already killed Kirk, but he just grabs her, takes her inside, so matter-of-factly just hangs her up on that hook, and that's what affected me so much. Leatherface just puts her up there like she doesn't even count, like she was a pig or a chicken.
Exactly.
Whatever, we can put a chicken on a hook, but I guess a cow. And then she would, I guess, bleed out, although she isn't dead because she's in the freezer later on. Shrieks coming out of there when Jerry goes in the house and sees her, but then he gets clubbed to death by Leatherface, and he just so matter-of-factly shoves her back in the freezer. So I guess she would probably die that way, even though the actress thinks she probably survived. I don't think she survived.
Yeah, the matter-of-factness is probably the most sinister part of it. Something that's very heavily borrowed in Walking Dead and probably a lot of zombie films or post-apocalyptic films.
And that's what I think makes this movie work, is that it isn't really a big build-up. Maybe because there's no music, per se. The sound effects are the music. This just happens. Here you go. You came to my house. Oh, you're hung on a hook. And she doesn't die there, but she looks like she could. We talked about how this was a rough shoot. This is nowhere near as bad as some of the other things that happened, like Edwin Neal complaining about is worse than Vietnam. But when Terry McMinn got hung on that hook, she had a harness that actually hung her, but it was cutting into her crotch. And she may not be a guy, but still, that hurt badly enough that she didn't have to act that scene all that much. And then the other thing, too, is that when she's hanging there, she's got to watch her boyfriend being cut up by this chainsaw. Which, again, you see the chainsaw go on. You don't see, I don't think, any blood. You certainly don't see him cutting into it. And in the sequels and the remake and whatnot, that's part of the problem with those films, is they just blatantly show you all kinds of chainsaw action and everything else. People's brains getting blown out. The girl in the opening sequence of the remake that blows her own brains out, and they show that happening. It's kind of cool, I guess, because you can do it digitally. But the fact that you don't see everything in this movie, it's more about what you imagine, as people have said 1,000 times, is what really works in horror films.
This is so much less gory than I expected it to be. And part of the reason why I'd never seen it before is because I was always warned that this was the scariest, most violent film. It was rated X. They had to cut it down to get it an R rating. People walked out of the film in disgust. It was banned in all kinds of places, including Ottawa, Australia, Iceland, Ireland, Norway, Singapore, Sweden, Germany, for violence when you watch it now. And of course, we're acclimated to much more violent films, but in the 70s, is this really more violent than Bonnie and Clyde?
No, it's not. That was 67, and that is way more blatant. Certainly Wild Bunch is, too.
Yes, Wild Bunch, absolutely.
And those are thought of as artwork, although I think this movie, Texas Chainsaw, is it MoMA? I remember reading that somewhere probably 15 years ago. Because, like I guess, it had fame, but it has even more fame now as the years have gone on, I guess, and it's been 45 years now. And that's how special it is to people, and maybe because they don't just gorily show everything. Although the question is, as well, is the meat cooking at the gas station when Sally runs in and thinks she's found a haven? That is a cool touch. Leatherface should be right out there with the chainsaw. Now, he knows where she's gone. Maybe in his stunted mind, it's good enough to say, okay, well, let Grandpa, or Dad, gone, where yeah. she is. He's got her now. But when you see meat cooking, and they linger on it for a little bit, is that supposed to already be Kirk and possibly Pam?
Probably. Or another person.
Does Leatherface work that fast?
Well, I assume it's people, at least. Maybe not her friends. It's only been an hour or two.
And then the strangest dinner ever. Grandpa's ineptitude with killing Sally is kind of funny. He's the greatest killer there ever was. And because he's so old and infirm, he's tapping her in the back of the head. Ah! And one of her screams, it sounds like she's actually annoyed. And maybe the actress was. Maybe the actress was saying to John Duggan,
stop
okay,
hitting
get
me.
The take a little bit better than that.
It's a real hammer, too. It's not even a prop hammer.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so he's aiming for the floor. Part of the reason it looks so stupid is because if he had actually hit her, he would have hurt the actress.
He probably couldn't see her through that makeup. I bet that's part
too.
Of the problem. And he's not experienced. None
Madness.
Of these people really were.
He's so inept, and they're cheering him on. That moment is so weird, and the creepiness level is through the roof. You talk about it being in an art museum, and all I can think is most of the movie really does nothing for me, but that scene is art.
Mm-hmm.
To see something like that in the 70s, that montage of extreme close-ups, the way that the pacing is, the acting, the absolute ramping up of the insanity where you've known for a while there's something crazy going on in this house, but you don't even imagine that they have, like, a chair made out of human bones with actual arms that she's tied to, and their performance is so scary, and she's just stuck watching. It didn't really scare me, but I'm a little bit immune to horror films now. If I had seen this movie when I was 17 years old or something, I don't think I would have slept for days.
Right.
Still, 45 years later, looks groundbreaking.
The final stalk at the end, when Leatherface and the hitchhiker come chasing after, I guess the cook just stays inside and takes care of Grandpa. And again, we're in daylight now. That was one long night, because we see Sally and Franklin by the van, and it's become dark. So let's say in Texas, in the middle of the waning summer, that it's, at that point, 7, 8. And then, of course, she takes him along. That could take a while, I guess, in his wheelchair. I don't know how he'd get through any of that underbrush or any of those pathways. There's no real pathways for someone in a wheelchair. But okay, so let's say that takes a while. But they capture her, and she's knocked out for a little while. But still, when she jumps out of the window, for the second time jumping out of a window of that same house in this movie, they had a stunt woman to jump out of that window. But when they got the shot of her landing, which would probably only be a foot or two off of some little platform above the camera, that's what got her hurt, I was reading. So she got hurt doing that. But she runs away, it's daylight now, and she's saved by a transport truck and then a pickup truck. The transport is what kills the hitchhiker. Not braking, but I guess he really wondered, as you pointed out, maybe he was trying to run over the hitchhiker. Although he wouldn't know what's going on. He has no reason to try to murder somebody.
I don't know. If you saw a woman covered in blood, screaming bloody murder, being chased by that guy, you would run over that guy.
In Texas? I don't know. Maybe not. I might, but with Texans. Although this guy may not be a Texan. He's a black guy, too. So many movies we've seen of any type, maybe including horror films, don't have black people in them. But this guy, at the end, in the transport, who is her unintentional savior, is a black guy.
It's not unintentional. He intentionally runs over the
Okay, hitchhiker. That's your opinion.
Because isn't there a car that she tries to wave them down, and they're like, oh, I'm not getting involved in any of this, and they just keep going? Isn't there a car that just keeps going?
I don't remember that. I have to look at the last scene again.
I may be mixing it up with the pickup Ready truck. Or Not, which I saw like a week and a half ago.
I'm interested in the fact that the pickup truck that has her in the back, and again, because Sally, Marilyn Burns, is not a very good athlete, I guess. She's so slow getting in the back of the pickup truck. Gunnar Hansen, again, has to wait. Okay, she's not in the truck yet. I have to just miss her with the chainsaw. And she's driven away, and of course, she really has her insane break, I think. Her mind just goes at that point.
Yeah, but that shot of her scream, laughing, whatever, in the back of that truck, covered in blood, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. And what is the price of admission?
Because it is Texas, I wonder, what is that driver maybe going to do? Hopefully he takes her to the hospital or the police.
You really have a low opinion of Texans. They're not all murderers.
Well, just based on what this movie's showing us. I'm sure a lot of rural people...
I judge all Texans by the contents of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
No, based on what the movie's showing. The rural people probably don't like movies like this. Wrong Turn's another one that makes them look like they're all just out to kill these good-looking people. Well, good-looking, this movie is a little debatable. Kirk and Pam, I suppose, are fine-looking. But anyway, these people from... Not even really out of town, though, are they? They're not from that area, but they are, they're Texans, yeah, so... Yeah. You don't really hear a lot of accents in this from anybody, incidentally. And then the chainsaw dance at the end, which is one of the more famous things. Maybe the most famous shot in this whole film. I was reading that Gunnar Hansen did that because he was just pissed off. I don't know if this was the end of the shoot. It may have been the middle of the shoot, for all we know. But he was so pissed off with Tobe Hooper that he was swinging the chainsaw around. I almost to say, if I let go of this, it might hurt somebody or hurt you. So fuck you, buddy. But it also reminded me of Fox, because he's just so mad.
Fox our dog.
If Fox had a chainsaw, he would do that exact same thing.
Kill you with it.
One thing that Leatherface does in the whole film, when he wears the different masks, and this is more touched upon in that 1994 sequel, and I think some of the other sequels, too. I don't know them as well. I just saw the McConaughey-Zellweger ones. That's why it's fresh on my mind. Is that when he wears a mask, he takes on that persona. He's wearing three different masks in this film, and when he's wearing the woman mask, yeah, he does chase after Sally, but he's trying to get away, so he has no choice. But he's being domestic. He's even wearing a bracelet like a woman would. Not that men don't wear bracelets, but that bracelet is very womanly. And he's also a slasher villain in the Michael Myers, Jason Voorhees mold, who doesn't speak. He makes noises.
Well, you say it's the Voorhees mold, but it's the Leatherface mold. This movie came out
long before
any of these other famous villains. This was maybe its main innovation. A killer who is this lumbering, no speech. There's clearly something wrong with him. Not just that he's crazy, but he just doesn't speak. He doesn't communicate with the world. Because it's scary to just have this motiveless, unreachable villain that has no reason to do anything but chase you.
That's true. I think one of the problems with the 2003 remake, not that they deserve to die, but some of the things that happen in that film, you could argue Arlie Ermey, who plays the cop. Well, he's not a cop. You learn in some other films, he's not actually a cop. But that he could make an argument in his own twisted mind for, well, these kids deserve to die. They did all these other things. But the kids in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 1974 didn't do anything. They simply go to a family home and they go to a family grave. Just like A Night of the Living Dead, by the way. That's a tie-in, one of the many connections.
Yeah.
Those two young people are going to see a family grave. That's just to put flowers on, to pay tribute to their, I think it's supposed to be their father.
Their grandfather.
Grandfather as well, then. And through fate and dumb luck at a farmhouse, bad things happen, and just about everybody dies. Well, Night of the Living Dead, everybody we care about does die. In this movie, it's all but one person. Well, I guess we care about the Sawyer family to a degree, because we spend plenty of time with them, actually, especially in the middle to the second half of the film. So Tobe Hooper was a writer, director, and producer on this. He got the idea when he saw chainsaws in a crowded store and thought, how can I get through to get out of here? Pretty sick notion.
Yep.
And it is a pretty innovative idea to have a chainsaw be a killer's weapon, especially in 1974. If he had thought of that in 84 or 94 or last year, it would still be original and cool. But we've seen so many things be weapons for serial killers and slasher villains. At this point, there weren't really slasher villains. People always credit Michael Myers for really starting that. And some people would say Psycho did many years before. But truly, the slasher craze started with Michael Myers and Halloween 4 years after this movie. And then you mostly get knives. Myers has his butcher knife. Freddy has his claws. Leatherface has his chainsaw.
Chainsaw and sledgehammer, right?
Two yeah, actually.
That they use in the slaughterhouse.
He uses the sledgehammer more than he uses the chainsaw. To kill people, at least.
And that's one of the things that the Hitchhiker talks about in the band, is how they used to kill cows with a sledgehammer, and now they kill them with this machine. It's easier to...
The No Country for Old Men-esque.
Yes.
Thing. And the co-writers were Hooper and Kim Henkel, who did direct that terrible 1994 sequel, who's also an associate producer on this movie. We talked about the look of the film, which was not very good. Part of that may be, if not deliberate, then a benefit to the movie. Daniel Pearl shot it. This was his debut. He shot the 2003 remake, also the 2009 Friday the 13th. A lot of low shots, not just that one of Terry McMinn walking towards the farmhouse, but he used a lot of low angles. The editors, Larry Carroll and Sally, or Celia, it's spelled Sally with an E, so I guess Sally Richardson, the only cut job in the editing that either of them ever did, I don't know why they didn't edit more films, because this is, well, it is kind of slow for a movie that's only 83 minutes long.
Yeah, it drags.
So maybe that's part of the reason why they didn't get more work.
The first two acts drag.
So I guess we talked about the look and the editing and the music already, so you're not a fan of those things. Although elements of them all, I guess. We do like the score, because it isn't really a score, right?
When it works really well, but as a whole, it seems almost at times like a student film.
I think that's part of the benefit of it. I think that actually helps it, to be honest with
Maybe
you.
Maybe because I was a student filmmaker once, I just simply cannot enjoy that aspect.
How dare you be like me?
Well, listen, when I think of student films, I probably, much like the actors and crew of this film, do not look kindly on those experiences. They are not good memories.
If I may quote Paul A. Partain Franklin in this film.
Dude,
that was
there.
So weird.
It's so bad. Yeah. It's just bad. Call it what it is. Was it in the script? Did the actor make this decision? Did everybody in that room go, oh yeah, yeah, you're killing it?
You kind of want him to be killed.
He is the worst. The movie, to me, got good as soon as he dies. First of all, his death is cool. Like you said, it's probably the closest to a really scary death in the beginning of the film. It comes out of nowhere, and they're in the dark woods. He's the first person to get killed.
The only nighttime killing in the whole film, too.
It's scary, and it works well. It comes out of nowhere, and you're like, all right, we're finally getting to the last girl. You know that the good shit's gonna happen now. Plus, I was just so relieved that Franklin was finally dead.
Jerry!
Oh, he was awful.
How
so
many times
whiny.
They both say the word Jerry.
Jerry!
Okay, well, what happens next? I said already, Sally's mind breaks, and the cops won't believe what happened was real when she tries to tell them, because she seems like she's insane. So Leatherface and company keep on killing and eating people. Or the cops do investigate, and they're caught, meaning the Sawyers are caught. But let's say none of that happens. What do the Sawyers do now? One of their own just got run over and killed. So is it business as usual at the gas station after this? So, first of all, what do you think happens as far as them being investigated, if they are? And if they're not, what does the family do? Now, we've seen the sequels, but just because they're sequels, let's ignore that for a minute.
I'm ignoring that, but I'm going to take from the fact that the town was upset enough about the grave robbings that it made the news and they heard it on the radio. So, this is something that cops would care about. It would maybe be easy for the family to say, oh, it was our one son, the one that got run over by the car. He did everything. He's dead. Can you believe it? He was trying to kill that girl. Yeah, I don't know what happened to her friends. And like you said, she might be dismissed for being crazy. Although, I don't know. If I saw a woman covered in blood, of course she's going to be crazy. She's traumatized. I feel like I would listen to what she had to say. So I think they would get caught. What was the second part of the question?
If the Sawyers are not caught, what do they do now? Because one of their own just got killed.
Oh, they would just probably move on.
Ramp it up?
Maybe ramp it up. He was the bad seed of that family. He didn't seem to have a role.
I think he was drawing people in.
Oh, maybe.
Well, my house is right near here.
But
he's looking for people, I think.
Would be a way better recruiter for victims,
true.
Because he's got the gas station. And he can pass as a normal person.
For a few minutes, and I don't know if you guessed going in, when she runs into the gas station, Leatherface almost gets to her, but then just disappears, which is kind of cool. Did you for a minute believe that the old man, the cook, was actually going
to
help him?
I did, because when they first go to the gas station, doesn't he say to them, don't go to your grandfather's house?
Okay, there
he tries to tell them to leave, to warn them off. He says, I don't want to see something happen to those girls. I can't remember what he says, but he looks at the girls and he's like, don't take them there, because he wants them to
He's not tipping his hand. That's good acting, then.
No, but it's not just that he's not tipping his hand. Maybe a part of him in that moment is like, don't make me kill you. You look like nice kids. If you get close, then it's going to be hard to resist temptation or whatever.
And to have a hitchhiker do the right thing, because as we see later on, he can't be controlled. There's a shot as well when they're both in front of the truck. Not that it's the most innovative shot in the world, but I love the shot in Evil Dead when there are people losing their mind. I think it's when it's Bruce Campbell and the girl who plays his sister in front of the car lights, so they're just illuminated by the car lights and it's hard to even really see them properly. You see a similar shot with the hitchhiker and the old man in this. And of course, this was long before, well, almost a decade before Evil Dead.
Evil Dead is another great example of a low-budget horror film that so innovative. Did I could see why so that much of the small budget.
Yes, right. Of course. Probably a smaller budget. Well, it definitely was a smaller budget than this. Halloween, Blair Witch Project, this, and I think even Evil Dead really paid off considering how little they cost. And all of them are landmarks in the horror genre, whether you like them or not, whether they're well made or not, whether they're well acted or not.
Audiences care more about the effectiveness of it. They care way more about something that's brand new and surprising than something that is polished. So something like this that has pretty mediocre acting, some definitely uneven filmmaking, but because the ending is just so surprising, it makes up for it. A great example, something we saw recently that this movie reminded me of and was certainly influenced by Texas Chainsaw Massacre, is Mandy. In some ways it's bad, but in more ways it's just innovative and actually did something we hadn't seen before. Audiences just care more about novelty than quality.
And they want to be scared. And I think when you first see this movie, maybe it wasn't for you, but it can be scary. I don't recall how I felt when I first saw the movie. Maybe I wasn't scared by it. I certainly am not anymore, but I've seen it so often, so that's no surprise. But for it to make me jump, even with a jump scare, which is always a cheap thing to do after all this time, that's a bit of a kudo to it. So anyway, last thoughts on Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original 1974 version.
Well, I got to give it props for clearly being innovative, but I think I just am too finicky about quality, particularly of acting, to enjoy it.
Before I get to my last thoughts, I look at the IMDb credits, which I always have up now on these podcasts with our two monitors, and a guy named Ed Guinn, or Ginn, G-U-I-N-N, plays the cattle truck driver, and I clicked on his name. It is the black guy at the end who's driving that transport. So if he's driving cattle, he's supplying that to somebody to be slaughtered.
Oh my God, that's such a great point.
I didn't know he was driving cattle, I never know, so you don't hear any cattle mooing in the back of it through all of that, maybe because the chainsaw would drown them out.
But he's taking all these creatures to their death. And
how is he any different?
How is he any different? That's such an excellent
point. And our main characters bought and were eating barbecue. Something had to die for them to do that. We judge these other people as awful as what they're doing is, even though it, in a way, is what we're doing too. We're just not the ones actually doing it.
I also have to point out that this actor, and I guess this is a coincidence, his name is Ed Guinn, which is so close to Ed Gein, how do you say it?
I think it's Gein.
Gein, the murderer who inspired this and many other stories.
All right, so for such a grisly and gross topic, the movie's way more suggestive than it is overtly bloody or violent. Those sound effects are still creepy, unsettling, and I really like the she lives, but she certainly didn't beat the bad guys. She survived them. That aspect works for me as well because it's very memorable and, as it turns out, incredibly influential. A lot of Last Girl movies. Maybe this wasn't the first one that did that, but it set the tone more than people want to, I think, give it credit for, because Halloween outdid it 4 years later, but this helped set that tone. Other films, I guess, did too, but
I don't know much about it, but I think credit does have to be paid to the horror films that were being made in Europe, particularly Italy, apparently. A lot of these innovative, gory horror films were being made. We talk about the American ones, but totally possible that these filmmakers were taking a lot of influence from that school.
I wonder if they had the Last Girl thing, too. Well, we're going to deal with the Last Girl thing in a week. Texas Chainsaw Massacre was from 1974, so in 7 days we're going to skip ahead a decade to 1984 and take a steely and steel-fingered look at Wes Craven's A Nightmare on Elm Street.
A period of time so notorious for slasher films that the new season of American Horror Story is simply called 1984.
So the coming attractions trivia for Nightmare on Elm Street, or A Nightmare on Elm Street. Of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost of slasher villains, who has murdered more people? Mike Myers, Jay Voorhees, or Frederick Krueger? Freddy.
All right, so for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about A Nightmare on Elm Street. And in the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe or favorite the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where all of our over 300 episodes are available for free. That includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and many, many more titles on top of that. In exchange for all of this great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. It helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Spark Plug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 20% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code top100project at checkout. And that's all one word, top100project. And it's not case sensitive.
My last thought is a reasonably good question. They have no gas at the gas station. Maybe that was legitimate. Like we say, the cook seems to be sympathetic. But they're running a generator, probably all the time. Did they use up all the gas? Those selfish serial killers!
And cut.